Welcome to the broadcast. This is Michael Elias in Context, and it's a joy to have Voddie Baucham, Dr. Reverend, I would say almost apostle to the country in so many ways. But Voddie and I have known each other for a number of years, and it's a privilege to have him on in Context. What you may not know about Voddie is he's into martial arts. Not as though he's not a big enough personality, but now he can take care of business. So just be aware of that when you see him preach. He's a husband. He's a father of 9 kids, a grandfather. He's a former pastor, a church planter, also an author, a professor. And now he's with a fascinating school in Zambia, Lusaka. Did I say that correct, Voddie?
Yes, Lusaka. Lusaka, Zambia.
And it's the School of Divinity of African Christian University. And he's a dean there. And if you haven't already, you can find him all over YouTube. Over 1.4 million views on the Ben Shapiro Show, League Inner Ministries. You can find great messages. So it's just a great chance to talk to a friend and a brother and on a personal note, see how he's doing. And if you don't know about his ministry, I hope this will launch you into a great resource of a man God's using. So, Voddie, for those that don't know you, which is probably a small percentage of our audience, you grew up a single mom who I believe was Buddhist.
Buddhist, yeah.
So tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up around Christianity. I never heard the gospel until I was at university. And, you know, that spirituality, kind of Buddhist spirituality and Buddhist religion in my mother was really the only thing that I knew before I was encountered by somebody who shared the gospel with me at university. And so I came to faith later than some. Statistically, probably later than most, in a very different kind of way, just because I didn't really have that sort of foundation, if you will, and I came from a different sort of worldview and perspective, which really just sort of shaped the way I heard the gospel, understood the gospel, and shaped the way that I engaged in and continue to engage in gospel ministry.
Where did you go to university? Houston Baptist, is that right?
Well,
that was later on.
Eventually, yes, eventually. There was a very convoluted route to get to Houston Baptist University. But yeah, I actually started, I spent my first semester at New Mexico State University. And the reason I spent my first semester at New Mexico State University is because I got an appointment to the Air Force Academy.
Oh, wow.
And committed to going there and then decided not to go there.
So the last decision. Minute. Wow.
Yeah. That's a whole nother story, man. But decided not to go there. So ended up my, other choices. I was a football player. So my other choices, it was by then too late, except for one place, which was New Mexico State. So I went and played my first season there. And it was just because all that other stuff, had happened. But, God's hand of providence, that's where I ended up hearing the gospel.
That's fabulous.
And left from there and went to Rice University, spent most of my, college time there, but then God called me to preach. So I left there my senior year and went to Houston Baptist. So I went to Houston Baptist for 14 months, actually. Okay. So yeah, it was an interesting journey.
Well, I would say it seems to be symptomatic of your whole ministry.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
God seems to move you around the chessboard quite a lot.
Yeah, the past is prologue.
I would love to talk to you about your academy appointment. But anyway, so you went on then for an MDiv at Southwestern Baptist Seminary and then Southeastern Baptist. You earned your DMin.
Yeah.
And you've done some post-grad work at Oxford and Regent Park College, and that, I bet that's fascinating as well. I want to ask some personal questions, and then we want to get on to ministry, but 9 children. Now, I remember when you came to Moody, you were talking about, and forgive me if I get this incorrect, a multi-generational ministry. I think that was the phrase you used, and you have this commitment, large family, and disciple them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, raise up a bunch of intercontinental ballistic missiles that we would launch from our home. Yeah. That's always been the idea. That's always been the hope. And God was gracious. People ask me all the time, especially where we are in Lusaka in Zambia, you don't see, families that large, and they'll ask, why? Why do you guys have 9 children? And I always tell them, because we couldn't make 10, because.
Oh, my word. And do you have any twins in there? No twins.
No.
Boy. Now, you're also committed to home education, so your wife is doing double, triple, quintuple duty teaching all these kids while you're out doing ministry.
Yeah, well, when they get to a certain level, I take over teaching them. So I've got three of them right now. There's seven still at home, and so I've got three of them, and she's got four of them, and
We had four, and, you know, we used to say when you have two kids, you're social. Once you have three, you're antisocial. No one invites you over for dinner. So I suspect the Bacham family doesn't get family dinner invitations very often.
And, you know, even the people who want to have us over don't have a table big enough, you know?
You feed them in shifts. So let me ask a question. What's been the biggest lesson you've learned from your wife in marriage?
Wow, the biggest lesson that I've learned from my wife in marriage, probably patience and selflessness. You know, I think every man, when he gets married, has to deal with that whole idea of not just me, right, anymore. So that sense of selflessness. And then the patience, right? Because it's, on the one hand, not just me. And then on the other hand, not like me. And so the first one teaches you selflessness, and the second one teaches you patience. So,
and how long you guys been married?
It'll be 35 years in June.
What would you say is your greatest contribution to her personally?
Probably stress, frustration.
We have a seminar I want you to go to. Well,
no, really.
If you're learning patience from her, I understand why now.
No, it's really, our life has been wild, you know? It really has been. The last nine years in August that we've been in Lusaka. So, yeah, that kind of stuff. Up and moving to England for school, and up and moving to, you know, Lusaka for ministry, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's been wild. It's been adventurous. And it has stretched her, you know?
Any mom with kids at home educators, when you move, oh my word, it's a multiplier. So when you look at your kids, obviously we have four and they're completely different, you know, individuals, nine kids, there are people out there. And a lot of home educators tend to have larger families, or I should say you'll find larger families who choose to home educate. And there's a certain, I wouldn't say gifting or personality, but there's a certain acumen how we're going to do this. Because when you have two kids, it's one-on-one defense. After that, it's zone. And so some tips for maybe young couples might be listening and going, yo, God, we'd like a big family, but how do you afford it? And how do you do all that? And, you know, teething and, you know, vaccines and doctor visits and instruments and sports. And, you know, even if you're home educating, it's just a multiplier.
Yeah, it really is. I think you hit the nail on the head when you said acumen, right? A lot of people think it's a gifting or whatever. For example, the organization that it takes, the discipline that it takes, right? And so they think God gave you all those children because of the organization and discipline that he knew you had. And then it's like, no, God gave us the organization and discipline through giving us all these children, right? So yeah, it is. It is accurate. Yeah.
We have friends in Florida. I think they had 13. When they traveled, just the two of them, she had a box, huge box in the front seat on the floor, and it was a file folder on each child. And she would go through different things, that to-do list, you know, and they were like, talk about organization. This may be indelicate, but when you go out and speak and people come up and ask questions and they go, you know, we've thought about a big family, or we're afraid to have more than two kids. What do you tell them?
Fuck it up, man.
Misery loves company. Yeah.
Stop it whining.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. Yep. That's a shout out to my friend, Senator Brian Birdwell. It's inside joke when he listens to this. Let's talk about your ministry career has been interesting because you've got this penchant, and I don't mean this to be inappropriate, but you succeeded everything, Vody. I mean, God gives you a gifting, obviously your voice, your command, your personality, your brain, that's a function of the man God made you, but you put that in a pulpit or you put that in a delivery system, it's intimidating in a great way. And you've got to know this. And so all these opportunities come along. I mean, you leave the ministry of one ministry, go to a different one. Tell us a little bit about those choices and decisions and how you guys prayed through that. Or was it just an obvious thing?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I mean, we've always tried to live life with our hands open, right? And ready for whatever opportunities the Lord would bring our way. And there have been these, you know, sort of major shifts. The most major of those, of course, leaving Houston and moving and going to Lusaka. And it was one of those things where I sensed the Lord calling us there 8 years before my wife did.
Oh, wow.
I had very little doubt about it, other than the fact that the Lord hadn't really called her. I'm a local church guy and one flesh covenantal marriage guy. And so for me, I'm not the type of guy who's going to say, well, the Lord told me, therefore I'm going to go announce to my elders and tell my wife and then we're going to go, right? I believe God gave me my wife and God gave me my elders for a reason. And so I waited for 8 years. And finally, you know, the Lord made that call clear to her. And then we went to our elders, put that before them. The Lord made that call clear to them. And it was only then that we left.
Were they pretty receptive of the idea of losing you? Or because you're a guy that has gone a lot, travels a lot, speaks a lot, has a big ministry, I know many pastors have a struggle with their elders or leadership model, and they don't like their pastor being away, and it causes internal tension. So that's an interesting study that were they like, okay, we believe this is God's will for you?
They knew. You know, they were not surprised at all. Plus, our model was very different than most. We had a true two-office model and not a three-office model. You know, we didn't have deacons and then ruling elders and then teaching elders. All of our elders were pastors. All of our pastors were elders. We believe that that office is one and the same. And so all of us were pastor teachers. So, you know, I was just one of the three pastor teachers at the church. So it wasn't like, you know, I'm the only preacher and I'm the boss and, you know, the boss is leaving. So, you know, no, we just went from three elders to two. It was a different situation because of our ministry model. So
tell us about being the founding dean and senior lecturer of the School of Divinity at African Christian University.
Yeah, so we went to Lusaka to help start ACU. And African Christian University is a classical Christian liberal arts university. We offer degrees in agriculture, business, education, and theology. I've been there since just before we kicked off, since just before we launched, you know, served as the dean of the School of Divinity upon our founding up until really last year. And now I'm just, you know, doing this in your lecture thing for a number of reasons, just sort of season in life mainly. But it's been interesting to be there and to see this thing get off the ground and, you know, to watch through, you know, growing pains that we're still very much in the midst of. And to see, you know, the fruit as well as anticipate in what it is that we're becoming, it's been great. Zambia is in South Central Africa, sort of landlocked just above Zimbabwe, just below the Congo. And so we're a very strategic location. It's the most stable and most peaceful country on the continent.
Wow.
It's a constitutionally Christian republic. So there are tremendous opportunity there. Right, for this work in terms of the impact that we can have. Zambia is about the size of Texas with less than 20 million people. So there's a tremendous opportunity for impact. Impact not only there in Zambia, but really in the whole region. From the first time I went, I had the sense that the Lord had put me together in such a way that I fit, you know? And that was a good fit for me. And it has been for a number of reasons. And so we've been really excited and encouraged to have the opportunity to be there during this whole journey.
So you've been there 8 years now, is that right?
Yeah, it'll be nine in August.
Nine in August. But you travel a lot.
Not as much as people think.
Okay.
I take four trips a year. They're about 10 days. About 10 days on the ground, four times a year. And when I'm on the ground, I got no rest time. I'm just, you know. So I do enough in those 10 to 12 days that people think I've been here for a month and a half. We control.
I just
that.
Have two words for you. Buck up.
Yeah. Absolutely. Really, I wouldn't have it any other way, man. When I come, I'm not on vacation. I got to go, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk about some hot topics. Let's talk about you're unafraid. You're like fearless. You'll tackle, you know, BLM, social justice, you know, heterosexual, monogamous, lifelong marriage. You'll unbraid the LGBTQ stuff. You're fearless. Where did that come from in your gut, in your head, in your heart, in your soul?
Man, I live in Africa. I can come over here and say what I want. You go, go, go.
Yeah, but you did that when you were here. Come on. You're kind of a spiritual pugilist.
Yeah. You know, here's what's interesting. Basically, I dealt with this in a sermon, I think, sometime last year. I really do like people to like me, you know? Some people think that I just don't care to be liked or whatever, but I really do. I want people to like me, you know?
I like you, buddy. I like you.
But at the same time, I don't know. I've just always had this sense of urgency about cultural apologetic issues. You know, I think part of it, yeah, I grew up in a single parent home. I've seen the fruit of that. I've lived the fruit of that. And then one of my undergraduate degrees was in sociology. And so I've also had the opportunity to study, you know, those kinds of things and to see the consequences of those kinds of cultural things. I've just always been sort of bent that way. And I have a desire to help people see and understand the consequences of lives that are lived in rebellion against God's design. I really do think that that's sort of where that comes from in me. And then, you know, personality-wise, I don't know, I've just always been a guy who's kind of willing to mix it up, I guess.
What position did you play in football?
I played tight end, yeah.
You're a big guy for a tight end. You must be fast, too.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of those issues. Let's talk about BLM. You know, we've got a whole bell curve of Christian responses to BLM. How do you articulate it when you talk about cultural apologetics or you're preaching a sermon and you touch on this?
Yeah, I go to the ideological roots. So instead of dealing with, you know, these things out here on the periphery, this event or that issue, this and the other, what I want to do is I want to get to the root. And when it comes to things like, you know, BLM, I want to talk about where the organization comes from. I want to talk about what their core values and beliefs are. Because at the end of the day, whatever they're saying and whatever they're doing, there is a trajectory. And that trajectory is based on what the roots and foundations are. And so for me, whenever I'm looking at those kinds of things, that's where I want to go. I want to get to the root and help people understand the root. Now, unfortunately, because we have a tendency to just sort of look on the periphery and we have a tendency to look at events or issues, a lot of times people will see what I'm doing and they'll say, I often get accused of, you know, being insensitive. I often have, you know, accused of, you know, not caring and all these sorts of things because instead of going out here, you know, with this event or this issue or whatever, I'm trying to get down at the roots of this. And it's unfortunate because I'm doing that because of how passionately I care about these things. I want outcomes that are based on the right foundations.
You know, I've been sort of grinding the axe the past 10 plus years that Americans don't know their history, not only our history, but biblical theological history. We're void of this. And I don't have any need to cast aspersions on seminaries or churches or Sunday school classes that didn't do their job, so forth and so on. But what you just said, and I agree, but how do we get that down to where the young mind lives on TikTok or Snapchat? You know, they're not looking at mainstream media. They're not looking at cable news. They're not reading the Journal or Breitbart or anything that sort of gives a, let's say, less than slanted view. And so you and I are talking about, you know, okay, let's understand Marxism. Let's understand what it really means to be a socialist country. as a Christian. My question is, are we talking to the, you know, the top of the list here and not trying to help the young mind? Or where am I wrong?
I have this saying that I often use with people. What's that in your hand? And it goes back to Moses and crossing the Red Sea. When Moses is crossing the Red Sea, you've got to ask him, what's that in your hand, right? And he uses this rod that's in his hand. Was it because this rod had particular powers to open and part seas? No, right? If Moses had been a soldier, he'd had a sword in his hand and, you know, God would use that, right? When I think about these things, I'm not trying to figure out how to answer everyone's questions, deal with everyone's objections, or get everyone fixed on this. I just look at what's in my hand. And what's in my hand is the platform that I have and the opportunities that I have to deal with these things at a certain level and with a certain audience and try to equip people so that they can use whatever it is in their hand to take that and apply it to whatever situation and circumstance the Lord has them in. And I think, you know, where we get in trouble is when we try to do it all.
Yeah.
Instead of just being faithful with whatever it is that we have.
Howard Hendricks was very consistent in that message. And he said, the problem with my generation, he said, you guys is you have too many opportunities. And you had to focus on one, maybe two things on your gifting and skill set and strength. But you watch young people today, and I'm sure you've got some interesting ideas about technology and your children. This is the posture. They're on their device. They're going to have cervical issues when they're in their 40s. And everything is short, quick, dopamine hits every time.
Yep.
And to detox from that and say, let's read a book. Let's mark up our Bible with a pen and think through. And again, this is where I feel like not a failure, but I feel like I didn't understand how to make that bridge, Vody.
What's interesting about that, I think it goes deeper than that, because even the way that young people are being educated today, they're not reading books anymore.
Nope.
They're coming out of high school and sometimes even out of college without ever having read a significant book. Or without ever having had to write a significant paper and make a sustained, reasoned argument, right? It's not just the devices. Here I go again, getting down to the root.
Well, no, and let me interrupt for just a second. I agree with you. My question is, how do we get them to move from that?
We got to not deal with kids who have devices. We've got to deal with this downstream. And we've got to reject this current philosophy of education. We've got to reject this current philosophy of parenting that gives rise to kids who don't read books, who can't make arguments, who think, you know, debate is evil, you know, so on and so forth. We got to get upstream from that. And it's ironic. You know, I've been talking about this for a long time. My book, Family Driven Faith, came out in 2007. And in 2007, I was vilified and people wanted to tar and feather me because I was urging parents to give their children Christian education and to pull them away from, the government schools. Yeah. And of course, you know, now I see that and people are like, yeah.
Yeah, I stood in more than one church and said, if you have your children in public schools, get them out next semester. And boy, I had to pay for it too. But, you know, they got these Christians who are in the government education, as you call it, and they're trying to do a good thing. But I'm like, yeah, but it's a big damn to plug holes in. But, and again, we, you know, as grandparents, you know, we have great investment in our grandchildren, and we're trying to basically say, look, we love you. Y'all do what you want, but you better not put them in public schools.
Absolutely.
And it's that, absolutely. You know, you got grandkids now too. And as they get older, the world they grow up in, I mean, they don't have any concept. And that's the truth of every generation. It's a dumb statement. Let's talk about what it's like there in Zambia, because I can't compare Western culture with the young minds in Zambia.
Yeah, it's a different deal altogether. Being in Zambia, being in sub-Saharan Africa, being in a developing nation, there's a completely different mindset. People growing up and desiring to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or whatever, not just so that they can go and make money, but so that they can help their country develop out of third world status. It's a different mindset, you know? Because of that, in some ways, it's incredibly refreshing to see people who have that kind of, you know, hunger and desire. But it's also incredibly difficult and disappointing because the resources aren't there. And so the education system is just not up to par, you know? So at ACU, we have a gap year program. Mm. Students coming out of high school, yep. They do this gap year program to help them even be ready for quality tertiary, you know, instruction. It's incredibly challenging. So on the one hand, it's encouraging because of that hunger and that drive, but then it can also be, you know, really challenging mm-hmm. because of the lack of resources. But it's rewarding stuff, man.
Yeah, I spent a little time in Nigeria years ago, and ECWA was the Evangelical Christians of West Africa. They changed the name as I'm stumbling, but the number of people that would come to any Bible teaching with no resources was just the most overwhelming experience for me as a white Westerner. And the hunger for the word and the hunger, you know, to follow Christ, it just puts Western Christians to shame because without yeah. resources, their faith is real and vital compared to all the props that we construct over in the West, myself included. I'm guilty. Help us out a little bit, Vodi. You have been unafraid to talk about race issues in the country. Give us Vodi Bakum's primer on race issues in the States and the Western culture.
I think it's so ironic. Just talking about America, for example, America is one of, if not the least racist multi-ethnic countries, let alone majority white countries on the planet, like hands down, bar none. And it's so ironic that people talk about America like it is hands down, bar none, the most racist country in the world. And that's because these people haven't been to Asia and seen the kind of racism that various Asian cultures express towards one another, or they haven't been to Africa to see the kind of tribal ethnic hatred, you know, the Hutus and the Tutsis, man. That wasn't Westerners, you know, who carried that out. And so I think one of the problems is that there is an ideology that has gained a foothold in America and in much of the West. It's this, you know, neo-Marxist, cultural Marxist, however you want to frame it, ideology, is serving as a wedge between people, convincing them of this oppressor-oppressed power dynamic and convincing them, you know what I mean, that everything at the end of the day is about race and about power. It's kind of just like the feminist thing, right? Who are the wealthiest, healthiest, safest women on planet Earth? Those in the Western world, period. But what women scream the loudest about being oppressed? Yeah. You know, it's the women in the Western world, you know? I think we have to understand that there's a reason, you know, here we are where racism in America has been real, but is on its sort of last gasp, you know, and yet we talk about it like it's 1863.
Well, I appreciate your acknowledgement about the feminist issue in particular, because that's, you know, I've been a staunch complementarian, and that fight has been fascinating to watch how it's bifurcated and popularized in the Christian culture between two loud voices. And now there's all the consequent splits, and we don't like the word evangelical anymore. We have to have a new word for complementarianism. And I'm going, why are we ever dodging, Vodi? Nomenclature to me is so important. And we continue to change it. We could go back to pro-choice versus pro-abortion. You know, a congressman friend of mine used to say, it's the party of life or the party of death. I go, well, when you say it that way, you're not going to get a lot of votes. But there's this yeah. differentiation, and nomenclature captures this stuff. And then again, back to our 20-year-olds who, I don't mean to be unkind, they don't understand the critical thinking behind what you just articulated. They don't understand the context, because the only place they're going to get it is in a very small place, like a classical education or home education or a true Christian college.
Yeah. Go back to what you said about the ignorance about history of America, the history of the church, but also just this ignorance about world history. And then when you get these devices and live your life in these echo chambers, it really becomes difficult, you know? So we've got our work cut out for us. That's, you know, why I'm just so passionate and have been so passionate about education, you know? At the end of the day, that's where the reclamation has to happen. We got to reclaim that, you know?
When I left the pastorate to go to Moody, that was a similar track for me. Was like, okay, I can, you know, and it was a magnificent church to serve in that area. We loved it, loved incredible people. But it seemed like maybe I need to go back and help the younger minds think more critically. Yeah. That was at least the notion I think the Lord was, you know, pointing me in that direction.
Yeah.
And not unlike you guys, I wouldn't move in 9 kids, but not unlike you, it was like we were leaving a womb, well-paid, great friends, great church, and you're going into a completely different environment. It was fascinating because the students I found very open, very willing to learn, very receptive, but it's like any place, you have the entrenched bureaucracies and administrative policies and longstanding voices that are pretty hard to change.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that big ship is really hard to turn, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, that's why, you know, when I was in the U.S., I was a church planter. And then, you know, went to Zambia to help start the university, right?
Touché. Yeah, not like you weren't asked to be the president of a lot of organizations. Yeah, I get it. Well, let's help out some of our folks and our friends in context. 2-3 top concerns you have for the believer.
Wow. I think one we've already addressed, and that is this sort of ahistorical orientation that believers tend to have. I think another one is we have this very poor understanding of the gospel. We think that the gospel is something that lost people need to be saved, and we don't understand that the gospel is something that is the core of the believer's life, right? I didn't need the gospel then. I need the gospel, period. And I think because of that sort of legalism and moralism kind of rule the lives of many Christians. And then I think a third one would be, you know, this whole idea of the lordship of Christ. What I mean by that is, you know, this whole big discussion now about Christian nationalism. Most people have no idea what that means. So whenever people ask me about it, I always say, first define your terms, right? What do you mean when you say that? And for some people, when they say Christian nationalism, what they mean is any Christian who believes in applying biblical truth and morality outside of the church, right? Any Christian who believes that, you know, we need to be advocating for that in the broader culture, you know, they put that label on, because many Christians have bought into a kind of pietism, this kind of view that says, you know, your Christianity is just what you experience in the church, you know, just what you experience, you know, among your Christian circles, and doesn't really have any sort of usefulness out there, you know.
I just interviewed Mark David Hall. He teaches at Regent, and he's a fellow, brilliant cat, written 15 books. This has become sort of his signature is Christian nationalism. And talking to him just yesterday, this whole Christian, you're right, defining the term is extraordinarily complex. And even among so-called Christian authors, the differentiation. I want to go back to lordship salvation for a minute, or lordship of Christ. When I was in seminary, Charles Ryrie had written a book called So Great a Salvation. And John MacArthur wrote a polemic, The Gospel According to Jesus, which we always subtitled by John MacArthur. and this became a debate. And in those days, it was done in books. You write a book, they write a book, you write a book. Unfortunately, some of the ragtag associations with that were very unkind to really godly people. And those of us that knew some of the targets were like, why are Christians doing this to and at each other? But a seminal point with lordship, and I'd like to hear your take on it, the cliche was, if he's not Lord of all, he's not Lord at all. defining that, Bodhi, is really precarious from a New Testament perspective.
Yeah, it really is. And when I, you know, mention that, I'm really talking about it, you know, not just from an individual salvation standpoint. I'm talking about it more from a Kuiperian perspective, right? I'm talking about the Lordship of Christ, not just over every area of my life, but over every area of life, period, right? You know, versus this idea that, you know, has this sort of sacred and secular divide and okay over here, but not over there. And I want to press the Lordship of Christ everywhere.
Okay, right? But help me define that, because again, traditionally, it's almost a kind of perfectionism. You know, if you're living a characteristic sin we talk about in the sanctification, you cannot be a Christian if you live this way.
Yeah, and again, that's categorically a different thing than what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the Lordship salvation debate, right? I'm talking about Christ's Lordship writ large. For example, should we as Christians be involved in this, you know, you brought up earlier, the life debate, right? Should we as Christians be involved in the life debate, or should we as Christians say, that's political life, that's out there. Yep. We just need to preach the gospel in here and not go out there. That's what I'm talking about. So I think we're having
That's good clarification. So, I mean, to that regard, you know, we've often said, look, if your wiring is to be a politician, I'd like to have a Christian politician. David Hall, who is an academic writing for the masses now, trying to say, I'm trying to, back to my conversation, educate younger minds with our history and what the leverage you have. I remember a friend of mine, Bob McEwen, was a congressman in Ohio for 12 or 14 years. I one time asked him, I said, you know, pastors don't want to talk about politics in the pulpit, and we're afraid of this losing our tax-exempt status. And I said, yet, on the other cultures, in African-American cultures, whatever, you can have a candidate take over the whole service and there's no fear of, you know, consequences. And he turned on his heel and said, name me one time any pastor has lost their tax-exempt status because they said, I am going to vote for this. You got to make your own mind up. And just illustrative of the way you're using lordship is I have to have the courage to say, Christ is my Lord. Wherever I go, whatever I do, he's my one audience. And in a way, I don't really care what others may want to say.
Amen. Amen.
That's all you're going to say.
Yeah. Amen.
Say a lot. Say a lot. Okay.
All I need to say, man. That's all I need to say.
Okay. In the last couple of minutes that I got you, I really am curious on you because you've come out really strong on the LGBTQ stuff. Give us Dr. Bauckham's like thinking on this issue and how believers need to understand not acquiescing, not affirming, but you have to have a clarity of what you believe.
We not only have to have a clarity of what we believe, we have to have a clarity of what's going on.
Okay.
We need to recognize the fact that we are not being asked to stay in our lane, continue to, you know, practice and hold on to whatever we hold on to, live and let live. That's not what's going on right now. There is a new religious test. At the end of the day, we are being commanded to bow the knee to Caesar, to confess that Caesar is Lord, to confess that biblical morality is evil and that the Alphabet Mafia is right. You know, it's not enough, and people are finding this out now. It's not enough for you to be on your job and just decide not to put your pronouns on your letterhead or, you know, your email. That's not enough, right? If you're not doing that, then you're not playing the game. Silence is violence. It's not enough for you to figure out ways to use your fellow employees' names rather than their pronouns, because if you do that enough, then it becomes obvious that you're refusing to use the pronouns, and therefore you're engaging in that kind of, you know, violence. Again, there is a new religious test. We've got to be aware of that. We've got to know what's going on around us and that the culture is not saying, let us live our lives. The culture is saying, celebrate us, bow down to our worldview or else.
We saw that with the gay marriage movement before Obergefell. And, you know, early on, ACT UP, they wanted, you know, equal pay. They wanted partnership insurance and just leave us alone. And Bill Clinton's famous don't ask, don't tell. Those of us who understood the theological tectonic pressure, it would be, you know, accept us, welcome us, marry us, affirm us, celebrate us.
Yep.
And if you don't celebrate and endorse us, then yeah, you're to be vilified. And it's a strange time. You talked about divisions earlier. A lot of, you know, people that are sky is falling are saying it's the worst division in our country. I go, well, Civil War was probably, you know, a little bit worse than this. Now, yeah. Could we get there? I don't know, but it's a challenging time. But I also say, you know, this is the time that Bodhi Bakum is alive. This is the time that Michael Easley is doing, you know, whatever he's doing. And we have to see some purpose in that.
Amen. Yeah, we do. We also have to recognize the fact that this is not new. It doesn't surprise the Lord.
Right.
We've got to recognize that we have a part to play. We're here for such a time as this. We've also got to realize, too, it's ironic, but I'm encouraged by the fact that I think they overplayed their hand, specifically about 2S, LGBTQIA+, whatever. I think with mutilating children, giving children this irreparable chemical warfare on pre-adolescents, I think the overt pornographic material in schools, even the pagans, are standing up at school board meetings, you know, and I think they've overplayed their hands and there's a correction coming. My worry is that that correction will be a gospel-less correction and that Christians, you know, will be okay with that.
Two last questions. Let me ask you about, you're going to talk to 14,000 students here coming up in a Christian university. Give us a little inside intel on your message.
You know, I'm wavering between it.
I love it. Don't we all?
I just spoke to a group of men this morning. It was a 6 a.m. men's breakfast at a church here in Lynchburg. And afterwards, we did some Q&A, and a guy raised his hand, and he's like, are you going to talk about that at chapel tomorrow? I said, actually, no, I'm not. And then half the room was like, oh, man. So there's a lot of Liberty students in there, you know, and they were like, no, that right there, that right there. I don't know, man. I was convinced, but now I don't know, you know?
You know, the old BBC used to change news stories. Go. Now there's something completely different. They would just, you know, so you could give two parts without telling them. Okay, final question. What gives you hope when you look over Zambia, when you look over the West and the places you minister? What gives Vodi hope?
One, I think as Christians, we have an eschatological hope always, right? But beyond that eschatological hope, I also have the hope of seeing God's providence and being reminded that God is at work, you know? And that's one of the great benefits of being involved in ministry and investing ourselves in ministry. We get to see God doing things. And we are reminded that while all around us looks like it's going crazy, God's still doing his work. And we still have the privilege of being a part of it.
Amen. Dr. Vodi Bakum, thanks for your time. And for those of you that want to learn more in the show notes, as always, we have information about our guests. And I want to encourage you, two messages in particular, one that Vodi gave at Ligeter Ministries a couple of years ago, and his appearance on the Ben Shapiro Show. You will enjoy and be impressed with his abilities to minister and to challenge the culture. Thanks, brother, and I pray your time in Lynchburg goes well, and I pray your travels home to Zambia are smooth.
Hey, brother, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Did you know that In Context is fully funded by our listeners like you? If you are a regular listener, would you consider giving a one-time or perhaps monthly donation? You can give at michaelincontext.com. In Context is produced by Hannah Seymour, mixed and mastered by Sonomorphic, and music composed by Tycho and Blair Masters.